Our speaker for this session is my friend Jessica.
Thank you, Ellen. And thank you to the virtual region for asking me to do this. It's always an honor and privilege to lead an OA meeting because it's the fellowship that really saved my life. But with this many languages, it's like mind-boggling. I'm so moved. I'm a little nervous, so I'll just like I have to like shake it out of me. But I'll calm down as I keep going. I just realized, you know what? There's nothing really to be nervous about because me telling my story of compulsive eating is basically me telling my life story. And it's two other people who have eating problems. And to these people who are translating for you. So hopefully it could be a helpful thing. And what I will say here today is just my opinion and experience. It does not represent Overeaters Anonymous or the virtual region as a whole. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm so moved by the languages because I have had a lot to do with language, and with living in different places in the world. I've lived in six different countries, all where I went to OA, and that's actually the only reason I went to those countries because I knew that they had OA. Not every country does. Hopefully we could change that someday. But the virtual region to me is just so amazing because now people can go all over the world without even getting on a plane. It's like so cool that we could all meet like this. And I've actually been to OA meetings. I actually counted today in nine different languages, but I only speak four languages because the language of the heart can be such a powerful thing. And just sitting in a room of people of compulsive overeaters, if they were speaking in Serbian or Hungarian, languages that I don't speak, was so beneficial and helpful to me. We connect through the heart. Let me see. So, as I said, my name is Jessica. I'm a compulsive overeater. For those of you who might be from other countries where I speak, I will say, Sono Jessica, una mangiatrice compulsiva. For the Italians, for the Spanish, so, and all the people in South America, Latin America, soy una comedora compulsiva. Me llamo Jessica. And for anyone who speaks French, je m'appelle Jessica. Je suis autre mangeuse compulsive. I also studied Arabic for a year. Oh my God, was it hard? So I can't get beyond Ismi, Jessica. That's my name. Anyways, I was born in New Jersey in the United States. From the beginning, there were some pretty serious signs that I had a food problem, even before I spoke. But first of all, I want to say, and this will probably hit the Americans most, was that my doctor's name, my doctor's name for my mom was Dr. Hershey. Now, if you're from, that's like saying Dr. Lint or Dr. Ghirardelli, if you're from somewhere in Europe. So I think I was destined to end up here. I mean, with a name like that, it's a big bar of chocolate bar that we have in the United States. So here's what happened in the first year of my life. At 3 months, I tripled my weight, and the doctor had to tell my mom to stop breastfeeding. Then I ate so many carrots, and I turned a yellowish orange color. And the doctor had to intervene again to tell my mom to stop feeding me carrots. I was so heavy that I didn't walk until I was 18 months. Every time I tried to get up, because of the weight, I just topsy-turvied over. And I carried the weight everywhere, but some of it on my arms. So people used to ask my mother jokingly if she had me lifting weights. Because I had six fat pockets up my arm on both sides, and it made me look muscular, but it was really fat. So something was not normal even from the beginning. I remember my first binge, and the first thing I really remember about food was when I was four. I slept over at a friend's house, And she had sugar cereal there, which we didn't have in our house. So, of course, I ate four bowls. And then I spent the evening throwing up a rainbow array of fruit flavors, if you know what that cereal is, that specific one. You know, normally that might stop me if I were a normal eater, but I'm not a normal eater. So things like logic couldn't really play in and affect my decisions. Also, I was young, but still, I could have learned, I think, at that age. As a child, I used to love to go to my friends' houses, and especially the friends who had what I call the good food, the sugary, greasy, carby food. I was told a lot as a young girl, oh, you're just a big bone girl. In truth, I think it was, I just like to eat just a little too much. A turning point happened when I was a teenager. I saw girls getting like boyfriends or partners, and they seemed to be all the thin girls. With my obsessionable love for food, I was hardly thin at that point. I was a big boned girl. But there was a problem that I wanted to be thin and I still loved food. And I do want to say this, that I came from a family like many of us, that there were issues, you know, sometimes divorces, remarriages, stepbrothers, stepfamilies, alcoholism, sometimes violence, like, but I truly don't believe that that was the cause of my compulsive overeating. I truly believe that it was something in me and perhaps something between me and a higher power that maybe I'll never know about. Anyways, because of the kind of like family situation I was coming from, I did decide at a young age that I needed to get away. So at 13, I got a scholarship to a boarding school. My family would never have been able to pay for something like that. It was really an excellent education. And in some ways, it was a challenging situation because I felt ashamed and embarrassed that I wasn't wealthy like some of the other students. And I tried to hide that fact by, you know, wearing clothes that were different. And also, I went to the school and I was overweight. And many of the girls there were thin and didn't look like me. And I said to myself at the beginning of the year, I'm not going to become one of these diet obsessed girls. I'm going to continue eating my blah, 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 and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But by the end of the year, I'll tell you what happened is during the year, the boys made a comment about me and they wrote it in the boys' locker room. And someone told me about it, and I was absolutely crushed. And, you know, I'd been told other things, move your fat arse, you know, things like that, the big bone thing. But the boys writing it in the locker room really, really got my attention. So after that, I decided to do what I call my one controlled period of eating. I think that's what it's called in the big book. That's what Bill Wilson calls it. And I did for 4 months. I ate very low, moderately. I exercised every day and I lost 40 to 45 pounds. And when I got back to school, I got so many compliments and I did like the attention, but not for what I got it for. Anyways, the first person I ever had a serious crush on, we were in a play together at that school, and he was from a major cake manufacturing company family and producer of grain and other food stuff. But I did love him for his voice. He had a beautiful voice when we were in the play. But I felt different, you know, at this point. And there were some differences about me. One of them was because of the food. I did end up with friends who also sometimes regarded food like I did and treated it like I did. We did our diets together and our breaks together. But anyways, that period after I lost that weight and I went back the second year, it didn't last. It couldn't. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I started eating whole bars of this and whole boxes of this again when the slightest thing, went wrong. And it's interesting to me that what I most remember about my school is where I was at and what I was doing with food. I don't think that's necessarily typical behavior. I think people might remember more their classes, their friends. And actually, by the time I was a senior, I was in a class, a literature class, and we read Hamlet. I was so obsessed with food at that point that I couldn't even tell you, other than Hamlet and like Gertrude, who was in that play, because all I remember is changing my food so many times to figure out what proteins, what fats, what carbs I was going to eat. So when I read it later in college, it was like reading it for the first time. So the food was becoming a problem again, and I started what seemed natural to me, exercising a lot and taking laxatives. And I thought I was pretty slick with the laxatives. Until one day, a girl came to my dorm room and she said, asked me if I had any laxatives. That was another serious ego blow. The dieting attempts and binges got progressively worse. It's a progressive illness. And it was so bad that by my senior year, I had to stop eating in the dining hall completely. I would get food and take it out. I just couldn't stand to be around people who could control their food. I was so envious and I just felt so out of control. Meanwhile, my skinny jeans, which I had been so proud to fit into once, were getting harder and harder to put on. And I would weigh myself up to 13 times a day. 1 month after turning 17, that was 2 years ago. Kidding! I went to my first OA meeting. I was so out of control. But even then, I don't think I had any idea what I was up against at that point. And to show you how long ago that was, it wasn't 2 years, I used to call my sponsor from a payphone in the dorm with a dime. It wasn't even a quarter. Anyways, I never left OA after that. So I came to OA when I was 17. Even if I was binging before or after meetings, or dreaming about what I was going to be eating during the meeting. They say that denial is not a river in Egypt. There's also an acronym for denial that I love. It's denial. Don't even know I am lying. And that one fit me like a glove because I really was just sick. I wasn't a bad person. I wasn't trying to like lie to like thinking I was lying to people. I just was sick and I had no idea how serious this illness could be. Anyways, so my senior year, I actually went to my first treatment center for eating disorders. And all in all, in the next 5 years, I'll go to two treatment centers and three recovery homes, long-term stays at the recovery homes. So I called myself a lot voluntarily incarcerated in my early 20s. And thankfully, the treatment center encouraged its clients to attend 12-step programs, including Overeaters Anonymous. And not that I had much of a choice at that point because I was so desperate, but I'm not sure that I would have gone to any of those places had they not had a belief in the OA and the 12-step programs. Because even though OA wasn't working for me, even though I kept going all the time, somehow I intuitively felt that my answer was there. One of the methods I used to go to change my eating was to go to different places. Since I studied and later taught languages and cultures, there was a genuine interest there, but my wanderlust also fit nicely into with my disease of compulsive overeating. I went to Spain first. Now, my brain, or perhaps my disease, literally told me that if I ate azúcar in Spain, it would have a different effect than eating sugar in the United States. Now, I am no Einstein, but I'm reasonably intelligent. And yet, I truly held on to the idea that if I ate sugary products in Spain, it would affect me in a different way. That was some serious denial. I also had my first boyfriend in Spain, and it never worked out with the other guy, the cake guy. And guess where we met? Burger King, I promise you. Scout's honor. Anyways, so when I was a but of course, where am I going to be going when like I had a bad day, so I'm like, I'm just going to drown my worries in like food. So I go to the American place that I know in Spain. But when I was a student in Spain, I did go to meetings, but I knew that I had to get to Madrid because they had more meetings in Madrid. And I finally made it up there and was going to a meeting a day. And there was a woman there from California who became my sponsor. After listening to my three subject notebook long first step, she looked at me and said, Jessica, I think you need more help than OA alone can give you. That was an ego bust. Then she proceeded to tell me about this recovery home on the other side of the world in Southern California. I was originally from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. She said she really thought that I needed to go. Well, at 18, arrogant and cocky, I thought she has no idea who she's talking to. I didn't say that to her, but that's what I thought. So I planned to take a 2-month trip around Europe, which ended up being a 2-week trip because I started binging in France, went through Italy, and was binging in Greece. And I had to fly back to Spain and go back to the United States because the binging was so bad. But my sponsor likes to say that, like, that the fact that I was from New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, she was from California. We met in Spain. She told me about a recovery home in California where I ended up going. If that's not God working, then I don't know what is. Anyways, OA was really flourishing in San Diego at the time. There were 144 in-person meetings a week in the city. And we had 2 meetings at the recovery home, OA meetings, and one of which usually got around 60 to 70 people. It was a really great community. The fellowship was very, very strong. And sometimes on Sundays, I would always go out with people from OA since I didn't have family there. They were called OA dates, and I got to know the people. So I really have a special, special feel for San Diego. In fact, they say it takes a village to raise a child. And I say, in my case, it took a city. It took that entire city, and my higher power took me there. And I'm so grateful because I couldn't get it before. There was women who I saw who had what I wanted. I hadn't really seen that before. There were people who were living their lives when they had eating disorders. It was so inspiring to me. Anyways, so when I got desperate enough, we don't have to go into every detail, but when I got desperate enough after about 5 years in the program, I just dove in and I really had the GOD gift of desperation, sometimes also good orderly direction. And I really saw that the people who were getting it were the ones who did the steps, who were doing service. And who went to a lot of meetings, or it's different for each one. We have 9 tools in OA, but some tools help certain people more than other tools. That's okay. Anyways, I just wanted to be done with this nightmare. So I really, really dove into the steps. And this is the part, if anything in my story, I hope you will remember how important the steps were. And I did a fourth step that was seriously this long. Now, mind you, I'm like 19 at this point, 20 maybe. And it was a trapper notebook. And the woman who listened to me, God bless her, it took 20 hours. We did it under a palm tree. And, it was so interesting at the end. I'll never forget. She said to me, sometimes it's easier to hate ourselves than to accept that our parents didn't know how to love us. It seriously took me 10 years to understand what that meant. And something else happened. When I did that fifth step, this was absolutely unbelievable for me. The evening that I finished the fifth step, we were eating at this table and they were passing something around that for the first time in my life, I had zero interest in. In other words, doing the fourth and fifth step had really taken away the compulsion and the obsession. Now, am I going to say I've never had it again in my life? No, because that wouldn't be the truth. This is a pretty hard world sometimes, And, if everyone were trying to live spiritual principles, which I've learned they're not, it can be really tough. And so I haven't 100% had that obsession. Some people have, and I think that's great. I kind of wish I were them, but then again, I kind of think if that were me, maybe I would never come back. And it's 33 years later. Okay, so those were like the steps, six and seven were also very important. I had a sponsor who said to me, Jessica, you don't need to do another fourth step. You know all your defects. You need to do a better sixth and seventh step. I had many people to forgive in my eighth step. Forgiveness was not my forte at the time. But doing the things that OA suggested in that OA 12 and 12, it really did help me find some forgiveness. And the other thing that helped was when I did my fourth step, I wrote what the other people had done to me. When had I done the same thing to them or to another person? And inevitably, that really leveled the playing field for me because it showed me that, oh wow, maybe if it was like 5 years ago, but I did kind of the same thing to someone, Anyways, I worked my tail off at those steps. And I also really started to listen to people. They told me I had two ears to listen and one mouth to talk. And I finally started paying attention to that. When it came time to make amends, despite the fact that I was 21, I had quite a few to make. I had this little stealing problem in school. And so I had there were people, a lot, mostly my friends, who I went back to and had to admit that I had done this. And this is how young I was and naive. The first person I went to, I literally bought the shorts that I had stolen. Oh my God. I'm like, now that I think about that, oh my God. Now I know, oh, you can give a check, money in the equivalent amount. But it felt so good. It felt so good to get those things off my chest. And I always knew when I was going to do an amend that I would have a relief after. I would have a feeling. Anyways, one really memorable one was with the family I lived in Spain. I moved in and suddenly all their food is disappearing. And they're like, where's all the food going? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean, the only thing that changed in their house was my presence and the food was all missing. So I went back to them when I made amends. And I actually got an email from them last week. We still are in touch, so that was really nice. Anyways, I think my higher power has a sense of humor because lots of things, but one of them is right now, actually, I'm listening to a fifth step, and this is the sponsee I've had that is the most like me I've ever met. Sometimes it's scary. It's like looking in a mirror, and I think my higher power had to wait like 30 years to give me her because it's like, whoa, sometimes it's just unbelievable. This will be an over 20-hour fourth step. Anyways, my experience in doing four through nine was absolutely essential for my recovery. I really cannot emphasize that enough. And that's from someone who had been to five times to treatment centers or recovery homes. And thankfully, some of them had a revolving door because I showed up there again. I have personally have done other four steps since then. I know some people stay in 10, 11, and 12, but I have had to delve deep again and pick up things. But I want to just tell you, so when I had, was it 6, 7 years abstinent, I finished college. I had dropped out of college four times because of my eating disorder and depression. So I'm just going to tell you in a short way, like what my life in recovery has been like. I have lived all over the world, literally. I have lived in Rome, in Florence, in Bologna, in Barcelona, in Madrid, in Salamanca, in Paris, in Nice, in Poitiers, in Brussels, in Buenos Aires. And then I've lived in cities in the US as well. And I just feel so grateful for that because I didn't think. I actually said to my higher power the last time when I came back from Spain, I said, okay, I won't ever leave the country again if you just help me to get abstinent. But you know what? That was my will and my desire. The higher power had me go abroad I've lived abroad for 18 years. And I mean, that's really a miracle for someone like me. But again, I went to places that had OA. This is a 24-hour a day program. So There is no way I think I'm better than anyone here. I know that I can give you this nice OA talk, blah, 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 and then I could walk out into the street and go to five stores like I used to. Because of the steps, I think that's not as likely today, but I really truly believe that this is a 24-hour a day program, and that the one with the most abstinence is the one who gets up the earliest. I just want to say the virtual region, I am so honored to be here. Like, I'm a little bit of a dinosaur when it comes to technology, and the people have been so gracious to me. Really, I mean, our chair has a heart the size of Alaska, and our vice chair has a heart the size of Texas. I don't know which one, I don't want to say bigger, it doesn't have to be a competition, but they are such kind and talented people, and I am really, truly grateful. And, you know, I just want to say that to me, tradition one is very, very important, and I don't think it's a mistake that it is tradition one. And I say that because I see the world in these past several years, maybe since COVID, we're having some real like divisive split issues. And I do think that the first tradition of unity is so incredibly important. And even, you know, I've been around OA a long time, so we're not perfect here either. We do our best. And, you know, I've seen some divisive, really nasty things, sometimes even in OA, but I encourage you to remember this is a program of principles, not of personalities. And we are human and we're not perfect. And that was a bit of a hard blow because I came to OA young. I was surrounded by all these people who were working a program and being very, like, very spiritual. And then when I encountered people who weren't, like, necessarily working spiritual principles or the steps, it was a challenge for me, but it's real life. And, anyways, so I think that's really what I wanted to say. I do the steps and the traditions with my sponsees. I'm not as up on the concepts as I should be, because they didn't exist when I got here to OA. I use the literature a lot. Actually, I wanted to show you. This is the 12 steps, 12 traditions in French, Alcolique Anonyme. This is the 12 step, 12 tradition in Italian, I dodici passi e le dodici tradizioni. This is the 12, los 12 pasos and 12 tradiciones. I have the three books in all these languages, and then I have it there in English. Because to me, those three books are golden. And, in fact, when I arrived at OA, they didn't even have the full 12 and 12. It was just the OA 12. And then they got some years later the 12 and 12. But I really do believe in OA. I really do believe in OA literature. I really do believe in the fellowship. And I feel so really grateful to be here at this meeting that is spoken in trans, you know, being translated into so many languages. And I really do believe that I owe my recovery to each and every one of you, because you're not the same face, but you're the same spirit as the person I went to a meeting with, you know, 28 years ago. And I really do think that we're all connected. And that's something really beautiful about OA. I sometimes joke and I say, God, if only like the rest of the world could be run like OA, it would be so much better. So that's all I'll say. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Jessica. Jessica, your first question is if you could talk about, you talked earlier about how it is harder to love ourselves than to accept that our parents did not. Can you talk some more about that? It sounds like a powerful insight.
Yeah, like I said, thank you for the question. I really didn't understand it at the time when I was 20. And it really took me years. It's really sad. I think, you know, sometimes we live in a society where I don't think we intend to hurt each other, But we do, and we pass it on from generation to generation, unless sometimes there's some intervention. And a 12-step program and working the 12 steps for me counts as an intervention, maybe therapy, a really serious therapist. And so I don't think that my parents didn't want to love me. I think that they couldn't love me. Like, and I'm not saying in the way I needed to be loved. I don't know why this is coming to mind, but my sponsor sometimes says, you know, because they say around 12-step programs, oh, they did the best as they could. They did the best that they could. And my sponsor says, they did the best that they could, and that was like a shit show job. But I don't think they woke up one morning and said, how am I going to ruin this girl's life? You know, how am I going to make it complicated? How am I going to give her like mental issues and have her have complexes? I just don't. But I still, you know, I have a fair amount of distance from my family. I've had a family of choice in the program, because it being around some of that makes me sick. And it's, I hate the word is toxic, but it's really unhealthy. I had a couple of boyfriends who said to me, God, you are such a different person around your family, like a totally, you know? And so that's what I think. I really am at the point where I don't think they woke up and wanted to think they could like ruin anyone's lives. I just think they were doing the best they could. And in some places it wasn't enough. It wasn't appropriate for me and my brothers to be in a bar when we were 5, 6 and, you know, 5, 6 and 8. It's just not a place for kids to be. But you know, it is what it is. And for me, okay, it took me where it took me. But that's what I would say about that. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Jessica. Jessica, how did you prevent any relapses?
Gosh. Well, one thing I would say is I feel like sometimes I got kind of close. I never got back to where I was. Like, I mean, but I feel like, and when I did get close, I would talk to people about it. I definitely talked to my sponsor about it. I would share it at meetings. I didn't want to share it, but they say you can't save your face and your arse at the same time. So talking about it was something that was very important to me. I knew that I was going to die. There was other people who thought I was going to die. But when I was in Spain, that woman, her sponsor didn't think I would make it. And she told me that the woman in Spain didn't think I would make it. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I do know that if I'm going to break my abstinence, I'm basically saying like F you to myself. And it's going to be the end, because you know what? That recovery home doesn't exist anymore. That revolving door is no longer. And, you know, circumstances in my life are very different. I kind of knew that this was my last chance. And so I would say that is probably how I tried my best to prevent relapses in my case, probably knowing how bad it would be, that it's going to be worse than anything I feel without a relapse.
So you have lived in many countries. How do you find sponsees and your sponsor? How does that work when you live in so many different countries?
I have had one of my sponsors. I have a couple of sponsors, and one of them I've had I had a sponsor. She had 52 years of abstinence. She probably still does, but she's in a, you know, place for kind of having difficulties cognitively now. And it just absolutely breaks my heart, because we were together for a bunch of years and we got close. Sorry, I think I deviated from the question. So Ellen, could you say the question again?
About how you have sponsor
oh.
and sponsee relationships
oh,
when
right,
you
right.
live so far around.
I mean, I go to meetings wherever I live, and I go in the language when I speak it. I don't regularly go to a meeting in Serbian. I went once. You know, it's not something but I regularly will go, in a French speaking or an Italian speaking or a Spanish speaking place. And I just share my story and my experience. And I trust that the higher power, I have right now, I have three sponsees. I'm sponsoring one in French, one in Italian, and one in English. And they just I met them all here, where in Belgium. And so it's a pretty international city. But sponsees are very important to me. I cannot keep what I've been given if I don't give it away. I really truly believe that there are so many important paradoxes in this program, and one is that I can't keep it unless I give it away. I heard it more when I got here. Surrender to win. So now as for my sponsor, I'm still in a slight heartbreak situation over that one I was telling you about, 52 years of abstinence. I have another one who I've had for at least 12 years now. And we talk on the phone, we talk on WhatsApp. When I go to the place where that sponsor lives, we obviously see each other, but we talk quite a bit, I would say. And I feel it when we don't. And then I say, I haven't called enough lately. But those relationships to me are very important on both sides.
Would you talk about your prayer and meditation practice and or meditation practice?
Sure. Thank you. Okay, so you see, I can talk. So and they say prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening. So I will be the first to admit that I've had a harder time with meditation than I have with prayer. I learned right away the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, the 11th step prayer. That one's in the AA 12 and 12. It's the God, Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. It's a really beautiful prayer. And so I will say those a lot. And I mean, I have a little ritual like in the morning, but I will say it's been a while since I've been here. So sometimes I've had to do something different to like spice it up a little bit because it's gotten rote. Oh, that's the same thing. Like I'll read pages, 86 through 88 in the big book in the morning. And then it's just like I didn't even read anything. It was just so I have to sometimes make a little changes and adjustments. Meditation for me, like again, I heard about this meditation meeting that I'm thinking of starting to go to. I have done it. I do struggle, so I do it best when I'm with others. The we thing once again. And I also, to me, like being in nature, like I'll go and take a walk in the woods when it's not about super exercise, blah, blah, blah. It's about appreciating what maybe a higher power has created. That to me is also meditative. And to me, listening to like soft music and that is to me like meditative. It calms my mind. I did go to in Boston, I went to a meeting where they did meditation in a group, and I love the group thing. I really do. So apparently there's this meeting. It's from the East Coast. I think it's 6:30. It's a meditation meeting. I heard about it this weekend. And there's 60 to 80 people meditating every day. So if that's helpful.
You've been in OA for a very long time. Can you talk about how you've seen the program change over the decades?
Oh, thank you. What an awesome question. Like I said, there was like no literature when I got here, no OA literature. That would be, I think, the first thing. There was no plan of eating. Let me just tell you this. If you said that you were going to eat a sandwich and broccoli and a fruit for lunch, and you had a sandwich and spinach and a fruit, you broke your abstinence. That was at least the way that where I came from. And that was on the East Coast of the United States. And it was OA, I think, has really made some important improvements. Like, I liked the program back then. I felt like it was my answer, my response, my solution. But the plan of eating was one of the most brilliant things I think that OA has ever done. It's just so, and it's a tool. And, different tools, people use different tools at different levels. People, certain tools affect people differently. So, if I have a plan and I don't perfectly eat everything on it, unlike when it was the spinach and the broccoli before the plan of eating, I could still have my abstinence, but not have done my plan of eating perfectly. And that, I think that leaves some room for humanity. And I think that is really smart on OA's idea. What are the other changes I've seen? I've seen it get smaller. I really have. And this is very sad for me. That same San Diego that used to have 144 meetings, I think now they have about 30. And that includes online and in person. I mean, that's a huge change. So it does, it scares me. And some of that I think is there's other 12-step programs for food. And my hope is my wish being little Miss Tradition One is I hope that someday we can all get together and agree that the plan of eating is people's own personal business, but we are working these 12 steps and these spiritual principles. And like, let's do it together. Like there's one AA, but that's my little ensemble pipe dream. And I don't know if that would happen in my lifetime.
Okay, Jessica, thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, and to everyone who attended this webinar.